You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Welcome, everybody, and happy Thursday afternoon to you if you're in the Milwaukee area. Hope you're enjoying the Air and Water pre-show as the Blue Angels take it to the skies for their practice routes. We've got some breaking news right at the top of the hour. State Representative Robin Vining is, as we speak, announcing her campaign for State Senate in Wisconsin's 5th District. As we've been discussing over these many days since the biennial budget has been adopted, compromise budgets never please anybody. And if we want a better budget that better serves the middle class and working families in this state, we're going to need a better legislature. Certainly, Representative Vining's campaign for the 5th Senate District is a step in that direction. Everyone will be watching the Wisconsin Senate races come 2026, no exception here on Civic Media. There's also been some breaking news at the state level, as the number of lawsuits filed by Attorney General Josh Call against the Trump administration for what can only be termed arbitrary and capricious, retaliatory, discriminatory, I don't know, lots of unconstitutional and just dumb reasons, has been canceling critical grant funding and other federal funds into the state, specifically in the area of education. We welcome the Attorney General to this program now. Welcome back, Attorney General Call. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thanks for having me, Maggie.
So let's just keep it to this month. If we go all the way back, there's more lawsuits. But just this month, you have joined with other states in filing two lawsuits against the Trump administration. Let's start with the most recent one. This is Donald Trump's canceling, withholding nearly $72.6 million in critical educational funds for the state of Wisconsin. These are what are called title grants. Tell our listeners a little bit about this lawsuit, why you filed it, what the claims are, and why it's important.
Yeah, well, first of all, the number of suits is really growing. It's hard to keep track of the exact number. We're over 20 cases filed challenging actions of the Trump administration. And, you know, a number of them have to do with unlawful cuts to funding for programs where Congress has passed a bill. It was signed into law by the president, often a prior president, and the Trump administration, rather than executing the law and awarding the grants, is simply blocking the funds that have been appropriated. And that's just not its constitutional role in our system of government. So in this case, it's over 70 million grants in Wisconsin alone that are being impacted that would go to support various types of education. That includes things in programs around the country, like after-school programs. It includes education programs for adult learners. So, for example, adults who might want to go to get their high school degree or learn English to improve their English. Those kinds of grants are being blocked. And it's part of a pattern of what we've seen. You mentioned that they've been attacking education, and that's right. But ultimately, what we've seen from the Trump administration is efforts to dismantle programs that provide opportunities for Wisconsinites and for Americans. And so here, as we have in a number of other cases, we've brought suit.
It seems to me, Attorney General, that the idea of a level playing field and providing people with equal opportunities and equal access and an equitable chance to succeed in their life is what's really under attack here, and specifically under attack for folks that are poorer, right, that come from more underserved communities that will end up harming rural folks the most. It seems very contrary to Donald Trump's base support, if you will, right? Like, if we just take at face value, oh, I'm going to help out the working families of America, this seems to fly directly in the face of that, because I don't care who I'm talking to, Republican, Democrat, independent folks that don't care about politics at all, almost all of us agree that education is the key to eventually doing better than your parents did and providing great opportunities for your children, and that without that, it's very difficult to succeed these days. What do you think, I mean, other than just dismantling federal government and making arbitrary cuts, is there a rationale here? Every time I read one of these executive orders or these letters that are terminating grants, it just says, based on presidential and administrative priorities. What the heck are the priorities other than making sure billionaires and megacorporations get larger tax breaks?
No, I think you're getting at exactly the point. I mean, what's happening is that government is being slashed. And when we say government, let's be specific about what we're talking about here. We're talking about slashing funding for education. So there's this effort to dismantle the U.S. Department of Education, first of all. But then on top of that, there are these cuts we've been talking about here. There were cuts, which we have another lawsuit over, involving grants that support mental health, the provision of mental health services in schools.
Yes.
So education is one area that has been targeted. But healthcare and public health is another area that's been targeted with efforts to significantly reduce what the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services does, efforts to reduce funding for National Institute of Health grants that look into diseases that support research into diseases like cancer and other deadly diseases. So less support for programs that help keep people healthy and help people get access to healthcare. We just filed a suit regarding efforts to deny funding for disaster relief preparation. FEMA right. grants are being denied. So leaving people more susceptible to being impacted by disasters. And again, in all of these things, what we're seeing is efforts that promote opportunity are being pulled back by the Trump administration. And then what we also saw in the bill that recently passed Congress, of course, is massive tax cuts for some of the wealth that disproportionately benefits some of the wealthiest people in the country. And that's what's going on here. Opportunity is being eroded while more money is being funneled towards massive tax cuts that disproportionately benefit the wealthiest people in the country.
Yeah, you mentioned the lawsuit over FEMA funding. We're going to be joined here on the show this afternoon by Tom DiLiberto. He's a former climate scientist at NOAA to talk about the science that is behind protecting vulnerable communities, specifically related to flash floods, of course, coming on the heels of just incredible loss of life in Texas and other floods in North Carolina, the flooding of the subway system in New York City. So we're going to be talking about that. Attorney General, in my mind, I can't help but envision this caricature of, you know, the corporate overlord boss in the smoky back room with the cigars, right? Like, how do we really, you know, give it to the workers and extract as much as we can out of them? Almost a return to these Gilded Age times in the early 1900s that led us into the Great Depression, where there were no worker protections, where there were no things like NOAA and the National Institutes of Health that were trying to promote the public's health, safety, and welfare, where a bunch of the wealthiest men in the universe basically divvied up the pie and decided who was going to be winners and losers and had nothing to do with actually supporting working people. Is the caricature an overstatement, or is that what we're looking at?
No, I think we're seeing a repeat of that kind of history. I mean, you know, take one of the provisions that fortunately came out of the bill that was ultimately passed by Congress, but there was an effort to prevent any regulation at the state level of AI for a decade. Now, overwhelmingly, the Senate removed that provision from the bill, but you know, you can imagine that that tech billionaires would have loved to have unfettered ability
to
develop AI without any intervention from states, but that would leave consumers less able to be protected. And it would leave us without an opportunity to take action to help ensure that technology was being used properly. It's one of many examples, but we're seeing it throughout government. That's why we're seeing so many of these suits. I will also add, we're also winning a lot of these suits, or at least getting
yes.
initial orders that block the Trump administration from moving forward. So while it's concerning what they're trying to do, it's not all bad news, because the courts in a number of cases have pushed back. But right now, there's a lot of litigation over what direction we're going to go in policy and whether the president can just ignore laws that were passed by Congress and deny funding that Congress has appropriated from states and from other entities that should receive it.
I want to put a pin here for all of our listeners. I want you to keep in your head what Attorney General Call just said, because later in this program, I'm going to address the tens of millions that the MAGA regime here in the state of Wisconsin has spent on outside counsel. Because the hypocrisy in how MAGA is here in the state of Wisconsin approach shared governance and what the powers of the executive branch are here in the state of Wisconsin, including the powers of your office, Attorney General, versus how they approach those very same questions when you talk about the powers of the Donald Trump presidency is truly, truly shocking. Attorney General Call, before we run out of time, I wanted you to talk briefly about the suit over the mental health care funds for educational programs. That's somewhere north of $10 million that the Trump administration has cut off. Again, this was approved by Congress in the wake of the Parkland shooting, the deadliest school shooting in American history, to help address mental health concerns of our students. What's happening with that suit, and where is it procedurally?
Well, we filed that suit a few weeks ago, I think a little over 2 weeks ago at this point. And, you know, as you said, this is similar to the one we discussed with the other education funds. But in this case, it was funds that were designed to support mental health programming in schools. They went to support training for mental health care providers, among other things. And again, we have a law that's passed by Congress. And rather than implement that law and ensure that it's being executed in a way that best serves the interests of the public, the Trump administration has instead come in and just said, we're not going to allow these grants to be provided. And so what that means is that kids in Wisconsin who would have benefited from these mental health services, if we don't succeed, will be impacted negatively by that. Back to this point about opportunity for kids and opportunity for Wisconsinites. If you're cutting access to mental health services or adult education, or making it more difficult to get student aid if you're applying to college because you've dismantled the Department of Education, all of those things are limiting opportunities for Wisconsinites and for the American people, all in service of this ideological effort to slash government and make more money available for tax cuts. And so this is another example of the same type of policy we're seeing.
It's truly shocking. Again, that particular school-based mental health grant program was established on a bipartisan vote by Congress following the Parkland shooting. It was designed to permanently hire 14,000 mental health professionals into schools. That's what Trump wants on the cutting block. Big thanks to you, Attorney General Josh Call. Keep the fight going, sir. Make more good trouble. When we come back, I'm going to talk about how Donald Trump wants to bypass not just Tammy Baldwin's recommendation for a new federal court appointee, but also Ron Johnson's. Stay tuned, folks. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome back, everybody, and welcome if you're just joining me. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Big thanks to Attorney General Josh Call for joining us last segment, talking about a few of the, I think he said, upwards of 20 lawsuits that the Attorney General has filed on behalf of every citizen, every resident, and every voter in the state of Wisconsin, seeking to ensure that critical federal funds that help support our school systems, help with disaster relief, disaster prevention, job training, and all sorts of other things critical to the support of families in the middle class here in Wisconsin are protected, despite the slash and burn policies of the Trump administration, of course, spearheaded and led by our billionaire overlord, Elon Musk, and his Doge bros. I think it's just appalling, especially the mental health funding cuts, 855-752-4842, 855-75-CIVIC. Have any of your kids been treated or diagnosed and assisted by a mental health professional or a social worker in schools? I'd like to hear about it, because that one just smacks of such cruelty. And the fact that Congress enacted this particular program and appropriated this particular chunk of funding in the wake of the Parkland shooting to help kids deal with trauma in schools so that they are prepared and able to learn is just gobsmacking. 855-752-4842, 855-75-CIVIC. Have one of your kids been helped by a mental health professional or a social worker while they're at school? Tell us about it. Again, that's 855-75-CIVIC. Phone and text lines are open. There was another bit of breaking news today that, again, sadly, was entirely unsurprising and yet utterly disappointing. And that is that for a very long time in the state of Wisconsin and in other states, when vacancies on federal courts, either in the state of Wisconsin or relating to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, which includes Wisconsin, Indiana, and Michigan, came up from time to time, either because a judge passed away while still serving or because a judge retired or took senior status, the process was to use a bipartisan commission to vet applicants. Based on that bipartisan commission's review and recommendation, the two senators, and in our case, a Republican and a Democrat, Tammy Baldwin and Ron Johnson, would get together, review that slate of candidates, and then pass along typically 3, 4, maybe 5 recommendations to the White House and the president for appointment to the federal bench. Well, Donald Trump has thrown that baby out with the bathwater as well. U.S. District Court Judge Diane Sykes, who will be vacating the U.S. Seventh Circuit Court of Appeal Judge Diane Sykes, who came from Wisconsin, will be retiring from the Seventh Circuit in October. So Senators Johnson and Baldwin engaged the process to have this bipartisan commission review candidates and make some recommendations to the president about who should be appointed. Now, again, you're thinking, well, what the heck does Tammy Baldwin have to say about this? We've got a Republican president. Well, that was the point of the bipartisan commission. And in the past, given whichever party would hold the White House, even where it wasn't the party of one of our senators, they understood that the nominees or the recommendation for the nominee to the White House would reflect those more conservative or liberal or democratic values, right? So they weren't, Tammy Baldwin or Ron Johnson, generally speaking, as this process has moved forward, they wouldn't say, well, I'm not going to allow this more conservative lawyer or this more liberal lawyer to be appointed simply based on that lawyer's ideological lean. Because the president has the right to appoint people to the federal bench. So it wasn't ever about that. But sources have told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that Trump officials, without any interactions with Senators Johnson or Baldwin, just decided they'd start interviewing people for this soon-to-be vacancy on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. Yeah, forget you, senators. We'll just take care of this one ourselves. And apparently, these interviews have been going on for quite some time, since apparently mid-May. And they have interviewed 5 people for that particular vacancy. Again, these are 5 people that Senators Baldwin and Johnson didn't vet, that the bipartisan commission didn't review. And again, Trump will just go it on his own. What I think is really sad here is that, again, this participatory process, the idea of trying to be bipartisan, to try to ensure that appointees to the federal bench are appropriately qualified, have appropriate temperament, has simply been thrown out the window by Donald Trump. And what is resulting in appointment after appointment is Donald Trump selecting people who are personally loyal to him. The most egregious and recent example of this is Donald Trump's appointment of Emile Beauvais to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. Even Federalist Society members and Republicans are appalled and deeply concerned about that nomination. His reputation is one of a partisan, not a lawyer that has a conservative lean, not as a Federalist Society lawyer, but as an abject partisan actor, lacking objectivity, bullying staff, and he's been accused of directing DOJ staff to invent evidence against Kilmer Obrego Garcia, yeah, the guy that got deported without due process to CICAT. So again, Donald Trump trashing norms, to all of our peril. It's not about partisanship, folks. It's about good process. When we come back, we will be joined by Center for American Progress advocate Mia Ives-Ruble. We're going to talk about the impacts of the big, brutal bill on folks with disabilities. I bet you have one in your family, in your neighborhood, or in your workplace. We discuss on the other side. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back, everybody. I hope your Thursday afternoon is going well. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. As always and ever, we've got a very busy show for you this afternoon. At the top of the hour, I'll be joined by Dr. Kristen Lierley and climate scientist Tom DiLiberto. He used to work at NOAA. We'll be talking about the Texas floods. Could we have actually prevented these deaths? Were there early warning systems that because of the Doge billionaire overlord cuts didn't happen? Is Trump fundamentally putting communities in floodplains at risk by the dismantling of NOAA? We're going to get there this afternoon. And at 5:30, I'll be talking about fraud, waste, and abuse to the tens of millions right here in Wisconsin. You're not going to want to miss that. But right now, I'm joined by a prior guest from the Center for American Progress Action Fund, Mia Ives-Ruble. Thank you for taking the time this afternoon, Mia, and welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
Yes, I need folks like you. I think we all need folks like you to help us ground ourselves in the very real world impacts of the big, brutal bill. So let's jump right in there. The big, brutal bill took big, huge, nearly $1 trillion cuts to Medicaid. It is also going to end up hampering Medicare because of the deficit levels. This, in turn, is going to have some pretty devastating impacts for folks with disabilities. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and how that's going to operate on the ground?
Yeah, there's a big misnomer there's a lot of talking points that are going out there that are saying that they aren't cutting Medicaid and that they're going to keep Medicaid for the most disabled. But I think people need to understand that disability isn't a binary thing. You know, it's on a spectrum. And the people that they are talking about are people who have made it through the process of SSI or SSDI, which is a cumbersome process to go through, where you have to submit a bunch of medical documentations and prove that you are disabled enough to receive those services. And so there are a ton of disabled people who are not within that category. It's about 2.6 million adults who are not on SSI or SSDI and have difficulty working, right? And so when we talk about these quote-unquote work requirements, which are, they're really paperwork requirements. Yes. Because we know that a majority of people who are on Medicaid and aren't eligible for SSI or SSDI are currently working. And so they're working minimum wage jobs, jobs that don't provide health insurance. Only 8% of recipients between the ages of 19 and 64 aren't working. And that is mostly due to them either providing care to their parents or children. So, you know, when we're talking about what population they're talking about, it's a minuscule amount of people.
Again, that statistic is only 8% of Medicaid recipients aren't working, and most of those aren't working because of other care obligations. It's interesting to me that if they were really genuine about this, and of course they're not, you could do an analysis, you could audit Medicaid, you could follow up with that 8%. And if you wanted to be draconian about it, you would figure out the dollar value associated with that 8%, and that would be the cut. But that's not what they did, right? Like the fig leaf explanation is not in any way, shape, or form borne out by any data analysis, and I'm including data analyses that have been done by Cato and AEI, the American Enterprise Institute, which are incredibly conservative slash libertarian leaning organizations. It just doesn't work. And this, I think, for folks with disabilities that may live outside of large urban areas with public transportation systems, with large other nonprofit services agencies, which can, albeit completely inadequately, try to at least assist folks who may be at acute need and risk because of the brutal bill's devastating cuts. You start looking into rural communities, and even that inadequate safety net isn't there. Tell us a little bit more about why this is going to be so difficult and painful in rural communities.
Yeah, what people don't understand is that the dollar amount that is paid towards Medicaid, which is a portion from the federal government and then a portion from the states, they cover specific services. However, that money gets doled out to many different things, like paying for wages for the employees that are there, including, you know, the cleaning staff and folks who are, you know, doing the examinations, et cetera. Yes. And then you're also paying for buildings, right?
Yes.
And so when you talk about reducing the number of people who are eligible for Medicaid, when that proportion gets smaller, it puts a lot of stress on places like hospitals and clinics in rural areas. In 2025, there were about 2,086 rural hospitals that received about $12.2 billion a year of net revenue from Medicaid. That's about a median of $3.9 million a year for each hospital setting. And these hospital settings have the lowest operating margins,
yes,
in the country, right? And so they aren't making a lot of money, and many of them are losing money. And so what we found is that 44% of rural hospitals are operating in negative margins. And as a result, more than 300 rural hospitals are at immediate risk of closure, which means that individuals who are living in these rural areas that already have to drive a long way to get to a medical clinic. I know my mom, my parents have a place up in Maine, and it takes an hour to get to the closest hospital. It's going to take even longer for those individuals. And so there's places that don't have maternity care.
Yes.
There's places that don't have specific services for some of the most at-risk people. And these people are just going to have to travel even farther. And some of them don't even have the transportation to do that.
Yeah, that hence my setup of the question, trying to contrast folks that may live in more urban settings with those in rural settings. And I'm just going to restate what you just said in maybe a little bit of economist terms, because that's the way I think about it. If you live in a rural area and you have a rural hospital, it is highly likely that that rural hospital is receiving a large part of financial support from Medicaid. It is further possible that that, relative to hospitals in large urban areas, that federal aid is going towards both physical plant and operating expenses, meaning it is essential for the continuation of services at that hospital. It's not only in paying for actual medical care. It is fundamental to the continuing operation of the hospital. Therefore, because rural hospitals rely so directly on Medicaid funding, and so many operate either at a loss or with extremely small revenue or net revenue margins, if they lose any federal funding because the federal government wants to require folks to fill out more paperwork, which if you're having problems, if you're living on the edge, your food or housing insecure, you're experiencing job loss, and you qualify for these programs. You take even a small portion of that away, you will definitely, not a question about it, lose rural hospitals. Have I said that fairly, Mia?
That
because
100%.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
Please go ahead.
Yeah. I think it's also important to understand that Republicans put out this, relief fund for rural hospitals, which is $50 billion. It sounds like a lot to begin with, but when you break it down with the number of rural hospitals there are and the time period that this would be allotted, that would be about $4.5 million a year for each hospital. And these hospitals, again, are spending millions and millions of dollars already.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about this second point, which I don't think most folks who don't have a family member with a disability or are not themselves disabled in some way are completely unaware of. And that is the fact that federal law permits wage discrimination for disabled people. Explain why that is, or at least the purported justification. And frankly, the Trump's administration, their efforts to lock that wage discrimination in place for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, it's really interesting to watch because a lot of folks don't understand that this actually is directly related to some of the Medicaid cuts that we're seeing. So 14C is an antiquated policy that was put into the Fair Labor Standards Act, which was intentionally, I'm guessing they were trying to be good. They were trying to find ways to get people into the labor market that had significant disabilities. Unfortunately, what it has become, the project has become, is basically paying disabled people subminimum wages with no opportunities to move up. And they're working in these sweatshop-like conditions, in locations that are basically glorified warehouses, sticking things into envelopes and sorting things. So these aren't jobs that specifically are inspiring for these individuals. Nobody aspires to become
an envelope stuffer,
right. Yes. Yeah, exactly. And so during the Biden administration, what they did was they put out a rule, a proposed rule to eliminate 14C, and Trump has decided to roll that back.
And the Biden administration's elimination of 14C would have simply meant that disabled people in the workplace are also entitled to that glorious windfall, also known as minimum wage here in the United States, which is $7.25 an hour, which equates to an annual income of about $15,000 a year, which I am unaware of any human being on the planet that can survive. Well, not on the planet, I should not speak so blithely. I'm not sure that any American can subsist on $15,000 a year. Truly, truly shocking. Folks, we've been talking with Mia Ives-Ruble of the Center for American Progress Action Fund, disability advocate and friend of the show. Thanks so much, Mia. Please take care of you and yours. We'll talk again soon. When we come back, I'm going to be talking about Donald Trump's election data grab and the election data lawsuit proceeding in New York State. There's some weird statistical anomalies going on. What exactly should we be concerned about here? We discuss on the other side. I'm Maggie Dawn, and this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back. And welcome if you're just joining us. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Remember, you don't have to just listen if you want to watch the show. Civic Media's got a YouTube channel. You can check the show out there. You can also go to at Maggie Dawn Show on Instagram, Facebook, and X, and Instagram, Facebook, and X, and watch the show there. Big thanks to our last guest, Mia Ives-Ruble of the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Just a quick final point about sub-minimum wages being legal for disabled workers. A number of states have eliminated that. Those states include Alaska, California, Colorado, Delaware, Hawaii, Maine, Maryland, New Hampshire, Oregon, Rhode Island, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Virginia. So one thing we can do here in the state of Wisconsin is get on the horn, call your elected state representatives, and tell them to get rid of the sub-minimum wage here in the state of Wisconsin. Our disabled friends, family, and coworkers deserve better than making $7.25 per hour. We also have some additional breaking news this hour on the Epstein front. Mick Mulvaney, Trump's former chief of staff, has claimed in an interview with Al Jazeera that President Trump is named in the Epstein files. Also this hour, the Wall Street Journal is apparently working on new details about Trump's relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, and Trump has been making efforts to get that stopped. Remember old Catch and Kill and Stormy Daniels? That was about an affair with a porn star. What do you think Donald Trump might do in this instance? And additionally, I hate that I am going to quote this guy, but that conspiracy theorist, right-wing nutjob Nick Fuentes, pretty much a complete racist. Yeah, even he's abandoning Donald Trump, who had dinner with him at Mar-a-Lago and has thrown him some love. Nick Fuentes has posted F you to Donald Trump. You suck. You're fat. You're a joke. You're stupid. You're not funny. This entire thing has been a scam. We're going to look back at the MAGA movement as the biggest scam in history. The liberals were right. We will see Donald Trump as a scam artist. Oh, my goodness. Just shocking. Also in breaking news, Donald Trump has been diagnosed with chronic venous insufficiency, which is why his ankles have appeared quite swollen and his hands bruised. That was coming out of photos this weekend. Well, medical professionals say that condition takes years to develop. So much for Donald Trump's prior White House physicians' allegations or claims that he's the healthiest guy ever to be in the White House. But I wanted to focus in for this last segment this hour. By the way, just on Epstein, tomorrow at 5:30, I'm going to share with you what I believe the mainstream media is missing in its Epstein coverage. And for me, this one is personal. And I hope you can tune in tomorrow at 5:30. Again, 5:30 tomorrow on the Maggie Dawn Show, I'll discuss what I believe the mainstream media is missing in its Epstein coverage. For the rest of this hour, and again at 5 o'clock, we've got a climate scientist joining myself and Dr. Lyerly to talk about the cuts to NOAA and whether or not everything that is possibly doable to prevent a tragedy like Texas from ever happening again is being done by the Trump administration, or if they're actually making the odds of that level of loss of life worse. So you're going to want to stick around for that. Donald Trump has now sent letters and has sent out consultants into a number of states asking for their voter rolls, election data, to inspect their election machines. You know, like all the stuff that he tried to get in the big lie back in 2020, but was shut down by courts. Yeah, since he's now president, he's going to just go do that anyways. And of course, Donald Trump nearly daily continues to perpetuate the big lie. The big lie being that Trump actually won in 2020. This is very concerning. Donald Trump, of course, issued an election-related executive order when he got into the White House. It has been substantially stayed by all federal courts that have looked at it. But the idea that the Department of Justice is going to now muck about in state election officials' records and processes and systems should be concerning to everybody, because under the Constitution, states are responsible for running elections. The federal government intentionally plays a very limited role to avoid a president, I don't know, rigging an election in his favor. So please watch this space. I guarantee you it is going to get worse before it gets better. The other thing that I wanted to bring to your attention is that there is an election lawsuit that is proceeding in New York State. It was brought by SMART legislation, which is the action arm of a nonpartisan watchdog group. They filed the lawsuit over significant voting discrepancies in Rockland County, New York. Specifically, multiple districts in Rockland County where hundreds of voters chose the Democratic candidate for Senate, Kirsten Gillibrand, zero votes were recorded in those districts for Kamala Harris. The statistical probabilities of that happening are quite low. And I wanted to, so that lawsuit is proceeding. A motion to dismiss was denied and discovery is proceeding. And I want you to also consider this. In the 2024 presidential election, Donald Trump flipped 88 counties. This is despite the fact that he did not win the popular vote. The last time that happened was over 100 years ago in 1932, when Roosevelt carried 42 of 48 states, but he did so with 57% of the vote. And even in 1984, when Ronald Reagan won 49 of 50 states, 30 counties flipped blue for Mondale. Statistically suspect. We will continue that analysis as that lawsuit moves forward. Keep it locked in. We discuss the Texas floods with climate scientist Tom DiLiberto and Dr. Lyerly next on the Civic Media Radio Network.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.